Szeretettel köszöntök mindenkit, dear friends, ladies and gentlemen. I think it is just right to use this sort of mixture of English and Hungarian on this occasion. So it's a pleasure to greet here George Szeneti's English poet and translator of Hungarian poetry prose into English as a member of Széchenyi Academy of Arts, or Letters and Arts. And I think I'm going to say a few words, introductory words, and then George will read out his talk speech. But before that, I'd like to remind you his splendid career. Jól emlékszem, amikor a 80-as évek közepén, 84-ben egész pontosan George föltűnt Budapesten, és nagyon hamar megtalálta útját a Pen Klubba, ahol hát valósággal, mint a megváltót üdvözölték, vagy üdvözöltük. Egy fiatal angol költő három kötete jelent addig meg, aki angol költő, de van hajlandósága a magyar kultúrát megismerni és fordítani. És az évek során hát tanulni lehettünk ennek a, angolul mondanám, a steady growth, ahogy a kötetei egyre gyarapodtak, és azzal párhuzamosan fordítói életműve is. Nagy szerencséje ez a magyar irodalomnak, hogy ilyen fordítóra akadt. Ugye a fordítói életmű, hát nem is tudom, kronológiáról is mondhatom, illetve kétféle kronológiai szerint, tehát minden esetre Madács Imrétől, Krúdi Gyulán, Kosztolányin át, Krasznahorkaira, ja, már ahogy ne feledjem, kérem, abban elég sok készült, Rakowski Zsuzsa, Orbán Ottó, Krasznahorkai, és egészen fiatal szerzők is. Elmondhatják, hogy George szólaltatta meg őket angolul. Ugye eközben, hát mint egy 20, over 20 collections published, I suppose, beleértve válogatott gyűjteményes köteteket is, és 2004-ben vagy 2005-ben megkapta a T.S. Eliot díjat, ami hát nagyon rangos ilyen a magyar viszonyok szerint a Kossuth díjnak felel meg, vagy talán még annál is magasabb a rangja. George most ugye Seven Transformation Scenes, 7 nyílt színi változás címmel fog előadást tartani. Az előadás nyelve angol lesz, de azért a bevezetésképpen is going to say a few words, preparatory words, preliminary words in Hungarian, a paragraph or so. És az előadás végén, ha minden rendben lesz, akkor át fogom nyújtani a igazoló oklevelet. So, George, please.
Köszönöm szépen. Nem ismertem a protokollt, még most se ismerem, de elmondom magyarul, amit leírtam. Leírtam, mert nem bíztam magamban, hogy fogom rendesen előadni, vagy rendesen emlékezni se. Szóval elmondom ezt a kis részét magyarul. Kedves hölgyeim és uraim, igen tisztelt akadémikusok, barátok, csak néhány szó magyarul elmondani, hogy milyen öröm, milyen órási nagy tisztelet nekem, hogy megválasztottak, mint külföldi tagja a Széchenyi István Művészeti Akadémiának. Nagyon fényes a lista, nem csak írókkal, hanem festő művészekkel, zeneszerzőkkel, építészekkel, és mindenfajta művésszel. Nem is tudom pontosan, hogyan érdemeltem, nem vártam, nem is képzeltem. Elnézést kérek, hogy angolul mondom a beszédet, angol nyelvű költő vagyok, már több mint 40 éve angolra fordítok, az angol nyelven élek. Nem bíznám magamat egy hosszabb beszédet írni, vagy elmondani magyarul, de nagyon köszönöm a türelmet, és azt, hogy egyáltalán eljöttek. Főleg köszönöm azokat, akik jelöltek. Szóval tovább angolul. Seven transformation scenes. The term transformation scene refers to a change in character that occurs on stage in the English version of pantomime. Pantomime is not the same as mime or némajáték. It is not silent. It involves song, comedy, an element of burlesque, bawdy, and cross-gender as part of a popular, traditional, usually Christmas performance. The narrative generally based on freely interpreted folk or fairy tales. Even tiny amateur theatres in very small towns, small companies, including the town where I live now in East Anglia, will compose one especially each year. You could regard pantomime as an aspect of the Roman Saturnalia or the Bactrian Carnival, with certain allowances. They're all holidays from the normal order of things, and by acting as a conscious holiday, confirm the normal order once they have been performed. I want to use the term to refer to some personal transformative moments between language and event, between language and self, between language and social life, between poetry, prose, and conversation, and between language and language in translation. These will necessarily overlap, but I will treat of them as chronological events. So my first transformation scene is English words, Angol Szavak, which is the name of the book that Corvina brought out in 2008. The Polish writer, Eva Hoffman, in her classic book, Lost in Translation, describes the experience of changing languages in early youth, when in 1959, when she was just 13, her family emigrated from Krakow to Vancouver. It was a wholly disorientating affair to her to begin with. Old words faded as new words for the same things took their place. She talks, for example, about the contrast between the Polish word rzeka and its English equivalent river. The Polish, as she says, energized with the essence of riverhood, of my rivers, of my being immersed in rivers, while the English word is hollow, lacking what she calls an aura. River, she says, has no accumulated association and, quote, it does not give off the radiating haze of connotation. It does not evoke. There is, she goes on to explain, no, again I quote her, spontaneous flow of inner language from which a private conversation could proceed. Of course, she writes this book very beautifully, many years later, in English, which by that time had accumulated associations and was quite capable of radiating its haze of connotations. Was there a price to pay for this? Was a child, Eva, with a W, lost to her? And if so, what kind of loss does that represent later? The important Anglo-Welsh poet, Edward Thomas, who was killed in the First World War at the age of 39, was encouraged to write poetry by his American friend, the great Robert Frost. Though Thomas had been a literary man, a critic, biographer, an author of books about the English countryside, he began to write poems only at the end of 1914. Maybe it was because he began so late that the consciousness of the poetic vocation became so important to him. This is particularly clear and poignant in his poem Words. That begins, and I read you a little, very little of it, out of us all that make rhymes, will you choose sometimes, as the winds use a crack in a wall or a drain, their joy or their pain to whistle through, choose me, you English words. I know you. You are light as dreams, tough as oak, precious as gold, as poppies and corn, or an old cloak. And the verses go on for about another three verses. The wind in the crack of a wall or a train, the lightness and toughness, the poppies that he later talk about, the corn, the old cloak, the burnet rose, the rain, the villagers, the dancers, all these are images that embody his sense of the language. He, as a poet born into that language, has nevertheless to pray that such words may become part of him, that he might write poems representative of such words. In writing this, Thomas is longing for the same sense of accumulated association that the Polish-born Eva Hoffmann described. Language, then, as he will know, is not simply an exchange of words, nor are words in any one language simply the equivalent of another. It is not like changing currency. I, as an immigrant, and yet a poet in chronologically my second language, felt this desire most intensely during my development in my 20s and 30s, and wanted to write a response to Edward Thomas's poem. That response was a poem, English Words. I will tell you about it first, then I will ask marvelous poet and friend Subtle Diana to read her translation, but I will tell you about it a little first. The poem registers the initial strangeness of English by using many non-English or slightly recherché English words, such as Froebelblocks, genii, gazetteer, and sprachgesang in the first verse. In the second, it lists some of the accumulated associations of unnamed English words, essentially through memories of English manners and events, through very English expressions such as mind your manners, minding one's manners, and how different English manners were from Hungarian ones. Waiting in queues, we wait in queues, waiting in queues, or at school for free dinners that were served at holes in the walls, which are known as hatches, your dinner hatch. Getting to know the interiors of English rooms, or the way schoolboys wore their clothes with their long socks rolled down and their shoes, which my mother hated. And above all, the steam of those kettles for English-style tea. All these associations provoked by the language carrying all these experiences and countless others in its very being, just as much as it carried the wind in a cracked wall for Edward Thomas. The third verse suggests that being aware of two languages leads to some lack of confidence in either. We prefer and assume language to be stable. W.H. Auden gives the instance of a mother pointing out the moon to her very young child, and how the word for moon and the experience of the moon are forever linked. One confirms the other. Once we find foreign words for moon, the authority of the first learned word is no longer total, and that in turn destabilizes language as a whole. Suddenly, language acquires a frail, exotic condition. The relationship between words and their accumulated association becomes ever more precarious. The last verse develops that feeling and arrives at a curious museum where the words retain their power but are somehow behind thick glass and are as brilliant as poppies, Edward Thomas's poppies too, of course, and as absurd. This is the only poem I will read in both languages. Aware of the strange relationship between them, I should say I've translated a number of Anna's poems into English, but while being capable, I believe, of understanding her poems and other people's poems, and indeed many hundred other Hungarian poems, which I've been translating over decades, not just as language, but as poetry, I'm almost incapable of feeling my own poems when they are translated into other languages. A sort of blindness and deafness comes over me. My own poem constitutes too thick a glass wall to see the translated poem on the other side of it. I'm just simply grateful that people should have gone to the trouble of doing this at all. So what I'm going to do, I shall read the English text and I will ask Anna to read the Hungarian text. English words. And I will just explain one more thing. The first line says, my first three English words were and, but, so. This is perfectly true. This is from A.A. Milne's the bilingual edition of Now We Are Six, which I had in Budapest before we went out. And of course I pronounce it not and, but, so, but and, but, so. But that was the introduction to the English language. So I read the first four verses. My first three English words were and, but, so. They were exotic in my wooden ear, like floorboard blocks. Imagination made houses of them, just big enough to hang a life on. Genii from a gazetteer of defamations or a Sprechgesang. Somehow it was possible to know the otherness of people and not be afraid. Once here, the words arrange their quaint occasions, minding their manners, waiting in the queues at stops and hatches. I got to know their walls, their wallpaper and decorative styles, their long louche socks, their sensible scuffed shoes. Peculiar though, their enigmatic smiles and sideways looks troubled my conversation, swimming in clouds above the steam of kettles. You say a word until it loses meaning and taste the foreignness of languages, your own included. Sheer inanity of idiom. The lovely words are dead, their magic gone, evaporated pages. But this too is a kind of spell. Unread, the vocables coagulate and sting, glow with their own electricity. I cannot trust words now. One cultivates the sensuous objects in a locked museum. Their sounds are dangerous and must be heard voluptuously, but behind thick glass. Their emptiness appalls one. One is dumb with surprise at their inertia, their crass hostility. They are beautiful opiates, as brilliant as poppies, as absurd. Anna, would you kindly read your translation?
I couldn't keep Sprachgesang, I should have. So this is a version that I might try to translate the first part again, but I didn't. So I angol szavak. And but so. Első angol szavai. Mint a Fröbel kocka, idegen a gyerek fülének. A képzeletem szavakból egész házat épített, hogy benne éljen. Beszéddallama, eltorzult, rejtélyes térképnevek, különös népek, nem rokonaim, mégsem volt bennem semmi félelem. És megismertem lassan életük. Udvariasság, rendezett sorok a megállóban, tudtam, milyenek a tapétán a minták, a falak, az oknik és a meleg papucsok. De láttam kétkedő mosolyukat, hogy összenéznek tejáskészletük és könnyednek szánt szavaim felett. Mondogatod a szót, míg értelmetlen hang marad, ízlelgeted a nyelveket, a sajátodat is. A puszta szó hangtest csupán, az értelem kihull, a varázs oda, az oldal üres. De csoda ez is, olvasatlanul torlódó, izzó hangok a nevekben, a nyelv önáramától ragyogó. Már nem bízom a szóban, érzéki tárgy, a múzeumba, tárlókba való. Veszélyes hangzásukat kélyesen hallgatjuk vastag védőüvegek mögül. Az ürességük bénító, ellenségesek, tehetetlenek. A szó gyönyörűséges ópiát, mint a mákvirág, izzó, képtelen.
Thank you very much. It's beautiful to hear it, actually. I've never heard it. I've only ever seen it on the page. That takes me on to transformation scene number two, a moment in a corridor. Sometime in 1967, I was standing in a school corridor just outside the hall. I remember this moment very clearly. I was with a school friend, Julian, who handed me a piece of paper with a handwritten poem on it. It was, he said, by Ian, another boy, whom I only knew a little. Julian did not usually read poetry, and it was a surprise to me that Ian wrote any. We were all studying sciences at the time, but I had begun to dip into poetry books in the library, especially when I should have been studying physics. Poetry was interesting because it was so short, so unconnected, as I thought then, to the habits of mind necessary to science, but I didn't think it was much to do with me. Julian asked what I thought of the poem. I read it, and I didn't like it, because I thought it was false in some way. I didn't say so because I didn't really know what was wrong with it. I just nodded. But at that point, for the first time in my life, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a poet. My parents had long intended for me to be a doctor, but I wasn't really suited to the subjects I had needed to do in order to become one. They, like many Hungarians, had a number of Hungarian poems by heart, but they weren't literary people, and I don't remember there being any poetry books in the house, certainly not in English, though there might have been a Madách and an Adi somewhere. I had no real idea what it meant to be a poet, nor even what a good poem might be at that stage. But I felt sure that poetry held some secret that was specially designed for me, and that I had to spend the rest of my life learning that secret. I felt equally certain that the secret had something to do with a sense of truth, that its use of language was different from normal use, and that it could somehow address complex feelings and thoughts that could not be addressed any other way. Not for a moment did I think I would be a novelist or a literary scholar. Now, all this sounds very improbable, but it is perfectly true. I entered the corridor as one person and left it as another. In practice, this meant reading and writing as much poetry as I could. It was too late to study English. I made friends with two other science students who had also fallen in love with poetry. We read widely and wildly. We stayed up late in each other's houses and discussed what we read, not as part of any systematic education, I have never had that, but as a series of chaotic chance encounters. I bought my first notebook and wrote something every day. Most of what I wrote was bad, maybe as bad as that bad poem that changed my life. But my feeling for poetry was vocational. It wasn't that I wanted to write a poem about this or that subject, but that poetry was the world in which I wanted to have my existence. If I were to look back at that moment, I would probably say I realized that poetry was a form not only of language, but of perception, that could open up the world and might even heal it in some way. Or if not the world, it might at least heal me. Fortunately, I did not get a place to study medicine and remained at school for an extra year. To fill up my time, the teachers decided to send me to the art room. I had dropped art at the age of 13. Now I picked it up and found I could not only do it, but that I loved doing it. At the end of 3 months, I took the art exam and passed with top marks. The following year, I went to study art for 5 years. It was there I met my wife, Clarissa, who is here, and where I found my first real poets who could help me develop. But it was that moment in the school corridor that changed everything, entirely for the better, as I felt then, and I still do feel. The third transformation, English becomes Hungarian. My first period as a published poet began in 1973. Out of a mixture of French surrealism and post-T.S. Eliot romantic irony, but by the mid-70s, I felt that was not enough. My mother died in 1975 at the age of 51, and her death crystallized some desires and discontents in me. It was not that we were very close by the end, but the death required me to focus on some essential that was missing in the poetry I was writing to that moment. I wanted no rhetorical gestures. I wanted the poem to settle naturally in both mind and mouth, to emerge out of the nature of the language as Edward Thomas described it. I didn't want to remain an exotic foreigner, but to become an English poet. The process was conscious and quite long. I learned to use more formal devices, much more rhyme than before, more regular stanzas. even if I couldn't be the crack in the wall through which English words might blow, I could at least be the queuing, the loose socks and the steam of kettles, or at least become more conscious that the words I was using were articulations of such experiences. My first two books in 1979 and 1981 were well received and won a prize. But by 1983, I felt this was no longer enough. In 1983, for the first and last time in my life, I successfully applied for financial support from the Arts Council so that I might visit Hungary the following year, in 1984. There had been one abortive visit earlier with the rest of my family in the summer of 1968. Now, that had been cut short because of the invasion of Czechoslovakia on the 20th of August. We had been in Hungary just 10 days then. I had been writing poems for about a year, but hadn't published anything. We went to the Balaton, I made friends with a nice girl, and we had to get out very fast. But much had changed by 1984. I had started reading Hungarian history and Hungarian poetry too, only in English translation. As I have often written before, my parents decided in 1956, as soon as we arrived in England, on the 2nd of December, that we would speak English at home. The result was that I very quickly learned English, but forgot Hungarian. And by 1984, I hadn't spoken it for 28 years. Those 3 weeks in Budapest in April 1984, during my teaching holiday, because I was teaching art and art history in school by then, and was a father of two children, were as much life-changing as the moment in a school corridor. I suspect that, as in the case with the word moon and the actual moon in the sky, our first perceptions condition our sense of material being. So, the first room you see is the first real or primal room. The first air you breathe is the primal air. The first hand to touch you is a model for all other hands. And that this process continues right through to the spatial sense, the formal sense, the sense of rhythm, pitch, and so forth. Everything else is a kind of layer on top of it and has some echo. Returning to Hungary recovered all of that without any specific set of meanings or contexts. On the one side was a new Hungarian sense of a recalled, voiced, yet languageless material reality. On the other, the apparently stable base of an acquired English language reality and material reality. The distinction was between voice and language. The result was an almost hallucinatory 3 weeks that was happy, but disorientated. What was lacking was the interconnecting text between the two. The poems changed, became longer, more complex, more rooted in perceptions of history. In other words, Hungary became a subject and remained so for the next 10 years or so, for three or more books. The effect of this in England was just as disorientating as the effect of being in Hungary. I began to be described as a Hungarian poet, despite never having written a poem in Hungarian. It was a strange reputation to have, a strange identity to wear. The books were well received, as I said, sometimes with great enthusiasm, but they left me a little outside what you might call the mainstream of English poetry. If the worst comes to the worst, I thought, I will at least have introduced Hungary into the canon of English poetry. The three books most affected were The Photographer in Winter, 1986, Metro, 1988, and Bridge Passages, 1991. After which my attention slowly turned to the experience of entering and living in England and becoming English, most particularly in a book called Portrait of My Father in an English Landscape. That's 1998. These books were published by two publishers, the second of which, Oxford University Press, closed its prestigious poetry list in 1999. When I moved to my current publisher, Blood Axe, the editor chose to reprint a big selection of my earlier poems in two books, The Budapest File, 2000, and An English Apocalypse, 2001. In terms of marketing, this was no doubt a great success, but it indicated a very sharp division between what were assumed to be the two halves of life, and left out a lot of poems that were neither about Hungary nor about life in England. The breach between a Hungarian and a British consciousness was not healed, if it was a healing, until 2008, when the same publisher drew everything together, all the previous poems, and put together the new and collected poems of 2008. Now, my own poetry is not at the heart of this talk. The heart is language and language as translation. But it can't help being the heart of my work, which is entirely in English and has to be read in the context of English language poetry, if only because it is the only context available to it. Nevertheless, I won't give any more time to my own poetry here, except insofar as it bears on the question of translation. Transformation scene 4. Hungarian becomes English. On the last day of that visit, 1984, which Gyöze remembers because he was in that room in Penn, as was Kunos Lácz, I think was Bart Fischstein, I think a number of people with whom I am still friends, I was approached by someone I now consider one of my dearest and closest friends, Vajda Miklós, and asked to translate 4 poems by Kosztolányi into English for what was then the New Hungarian Quarterly. Of the 4, I particularly remember Hajnali Részegség, which I think was a failure in my translation, and Szeptemberi Áhítat, which I thought fit to include in one of my own books, in my next post-Hungary book, The Photographer in Winter, which also included a new translation of Radnóti's Erről tetet menet and Orbán Otto's Ars Poetica. Here are the first few lines of Kosztolányi in English. Szeptemberi Áhítat. September morning, enfold me in your glory. Don't leave me, don't desert me, September light. Now when you blaze out inflammatory, leaping, tranced and conjured as my sight, lift me to you higher one more time, to death on superannuated ruins. Help me, September, let me cling and climb to you, my brother, burning and renewing. So it goes on for 3 pages. As you might be able to hear, the translation tries to follow rhyme and metrical pattern. Here's the beginning of Erről tetet menet, or Fourth March. His foolish hue once down, resumes his weary beat, a moving mass of cramps on restless human feet, who rises from the ground as if on borrowed wings, untempted by the mire to which he dare not cling, who, when you ask him why, flings back at your word of how the thought of love makes dying less absurd. The practice of formally faithful translation was not fashionable in English. In the time of modern poetry and translation, as edited by Danny Weisbord and Ted Hughes brilliantly, formal considerations such as rhyme and meter were considered to be distinct from meaning. Hughes, in particular, was very much against it. But my own practice, as a poet very different from Hughes, indicated to me that form and meaning could not be separated from each other, that form lay at the very heart of the process of composition. This was not to suggest that formal poetry, so-called, was preferable in general, or that formally faithful translations are always going to be superior. Only that form, whether of the ostensibly regular sort, or of the kind even followed by what you call free verse, and which nevertheless possesses certain formal qualities, was integral, and that whatever modification it might undertake in the course of translation, it still indicated the nature of the voice. So, for example, since English does not have a long tradition of quantitative hexametric verse, it made sense for Alexander Pope in the 18th century to render the Iliad in rhyming heroic couplets, as the English method closest to its Latin model based on usage at the time. The Anglo-American practice of translating meaning in preference to and distinct from form resulted in a great many poems in various languages sounding very similar, and I had grown discontent with that. At the earliest stage, and for a good few years, I translated with Hungarian help using a crib, a nyers fordítás, and notes on context, history, and association, generally as provided by the Quarterly, for whom I began to translate regularly. There were very few of us translating Hungarian poetry in England. Ruling out Ted Hughes, who spoke no Hungarian and was not interested in either form or cultural context, he wanted the nyers fordítás. That's what he wanted to work from. There remained Peter Jay, Thomas Orsak Land, George Gummery and Clive Woolmer, who worked together, and Edwin Morgan, whose translations of Verishandor were familiar to me from the Verish Juhász Penguin double volume. I came to Hungary every year after 1984, twice in 1985 and in 1987 for 9 weeks at a time as a British Council scholar, but also on shorter visits in 86 and 88. I continued to translate individual poems and to write my own. Over those years, I also worked on a commission to translate Madács's Azember Tragédiája. That could be a subject in itself, of course, but it's a passing note here. The original commission was to produce a stage version, but within a few weeks it was changed to producing a literary book version. During the longer stay in 1987, I would go into Korvina and check through the latest translated passages with my then-editor, Vajda Tünde. The book appeared in 1988. I have often thought since of revisiting the translation, making it more colloquial, more actable, and in many ways freer of the original. But like my other intention of translating Petr Ifis Jánosvitéz, parts of which I have translated, it may come to nothing because of other more urgent work. A great pity. I worked on translations of Csóri Sándor, Vas István, began to work on Orbán Otto. I met Vas and Nemes Nagy and was to meet them every year while they were alive. I was introduced to Verish and Rakovsky Zsuzsa. Later I would publish translations of selected poems by both Rakovsky and Nemes Nagy. The translations were all what you would call formahű, maintaining meter and rhyme as closely as possible, as indeed Edwin Morgan liked to do in his, very much in his own way. The friends I made in those first years, such as Kunos László, Vajda Miklós, Ferenc Győző, remained friends through all this period and beyond the Vas and Nemes Nagy and Orbán Otto, who are alas gone. Fifth transformation scene, Budapest 1989, neither Hungarian nor English. It is an extraordinary coincidence that the longest time I spent in Hungary, a little over 8 months, should have been in 1989 of all years. This is my third British Council scholarship, originally intended for 5 months, but extended to 8 and more. Clarissa and I came together and our children joined us later. We arrived in early January and remained till nearly September, spending most of the time in Haraszti Miklós's vacant flat through the agency of a mutual friend. I didn't know him. It was just that a friend said his is available. Well, that in itself was an education, especially as the events of that year mounted to their various climaxes on the 15th of March and the 16th of June. It seemed dizzily fast at the time, the various protests, the formation of new groups and later of political parties, interview with Dubček, which I remember very well, the cutting of the Iron Curtain wire, the hemorrhaging of East Germany. In the meantime, of course, there was Tiananmen Square on June 4th. I need not describe this year to those who live here and lived through it. Their transformation has been theirs, yours, to live with since. I made two BBC radio broadcasts about this on my return. And while here I wrote a series of poems tracing the course of events, those poems forming the core of a book called The Bridge Passages. It was probably about this time I began to translate my first novel, Kosztolányi's Édesanyja. As you may imagine, it is quite a different matter translating prose fiction. There's much more room for maneuver, but also more room for mistakes. Issues of fidelity and precision work under a different pressure. I am not a methodical translator who reads the book, then reads everything about the book, who then makes notes and only then starts. I work like a poet. I begin straight away and try to understand the voice and the way it may pass through into English. I immediately start testing English sentences under the pressure of the Hungarian. And little by little, I wait for the voice to emerge. Now, this may not suit everyone, but it's the only way I can work. The emergence of the voice in English is vital, to me anyway, even while the sensibility of the novel as a product of a different language and culture remains distinct. The book has to work as literature in English, otherwise it fails to become any kind of literature. naturally, I make mistakes. I made mistakes, I still make mistakes, and have done so from the start. But the mistakes, when they happen, happened, continue happening, and I don't think there are too many of them, are local rather than general. This or that specific detail may not be right, but the whole has to be. So, Edashanna works as a book in English. Kostolany is such a clear observer, so intelligent, and has such a delicate, ironic, lyrical, but not over-poetic touch that the reader trusts him. There's one classic error in my translation, where one form of the Hungarian you replaces another. It makes no difference to the book as a whole. I don't think it's my best translation. It was my first, and I'd probably do it differently now. Nor do I think it is Kostolany's best novel. I think Paciuta is, but it was very well reviewed. In the meantime, history rushes by outside, and every day brings its new, previously unheard of events. On the 15th of March, I went to the Petőfi statue along with the rest of the crowd and set off with them along the embankment towards Lánchíd. It was exciting and uplifting, but halfway over the bridge, I stopped and turned round. This was an important moment for me, another genuine transformation scene. It had become clearer to me, as events moved on after January, that I was not legitimately part of those events. I was more than a foreign observer, but I was not a Hungarian either. Even as I listened to friends and acquaintances talk, I knew they regarded me as an outsider. Furthermore, they were right to do so. I would not be affected by their fates. I was neither an agent in their affairs nor a subject of them. This should have been obvious from the start, from 5 years back, but it took me until the middle of the bridge on the 15th of March in 1989 to properly realize it. This did not mean that I felt obliged to withdraw my sympathies from those I trusted, or that I had to wipe Hungary, by which I generally meant Budapest, really, from its key place in my own imagination. It was only that I had no authority. I could not speak for Hungary, for Hungarians, even for the Hungarian child inside me. The child was a memory, not a presence. The middle of the bridge and the school corridor were comparable moments. Hungary had started breaking into two parts for me. Into a not very clear idea of a nation, on the one hand, and my friends and what they represented, which as far as I was concerned was the best part of the nation, on the other. From that time, it became ever clearer that these friends did not represent the nation in a narrow political sense, and that I could not represent them, not even in my own imagination, specifically as Hungarians. They were simply friends and fellow human beings in particular circumstances. To put it in sporting terms, I was not on the pitch. I was out there as a spectator, a kind of fan on the sidelines. I would love them and cheer them on, whether they were winning or losing, but who was the team they were playing against? That was a more difficult question. My sixth transformation. I'm aware that for you, my chief interest is as a translator rather than as a poet. For me, it's the other way around. I was a poet first, an English language poet, and will continue to be a poet to my death. I'm not a translator who happens to write poems, but a poet who happens to translate. But let me think entirely of translation from here on. I have been to many conferences on translation and have given papers myself on the subject. What is the nature of the activity? What is one actually doing? The first thing to say is that, of course, it is impossible. The second is that it's vital and must be done, and always has been done. George Steiner wrote that without translation, we would, as to put it, inhabit parishes bordering on silence. It would be insular little villages, really. But he also wrote there are no direct equivalents to words. Just as for Eva Hoffmann, Rzeka was not a river, so for Steiner, bread, pain, and brot were distinct, not identical experiences. That means we stumble at the very first obstacle, the dictionary, not simply between languages, but within the very same language. Our understandings even of direct utterance vary from person to person. Even between the urge to make an utterance and the utterance itself, there remains an act of translation. We translate from feeling to thought to utterance. We translate from visual impression to oral articulation, and vice versa. We make films of books, operas of novels, stories out of chance, chaos. Translation is our condition. We are the translated ghosts of a materiality that is both here and yet somehow somewhere beyond saying. Similes for translation are many. It is like a kiss through a veil, like a woman that can be either beautiful or faithful but not both, like the afterlife of the text, like the fragments of a vessel, like a window. The translator is seen as a ferryman, a servant, a mischievous servant, a seducer, a betrayer, a conqueror, a colonizer, a cultural imperialist. My own very imperfect simile sees a translator as a reader of clouds, as when Hamlet, in conversation with Polonius, suggests that the same cloud is first like a camel, then a weasel, than a whale. It is, in other words, a physical object with its own laws into which various forms may be read. Now, this is, of course, highly subjective and won't really do. Hamlet is being deliberately misleading. And yet it tells us something about the freedom and independence of the reader, as much as the translator. We do, after all, look at clouds and read them as faces, or bodies, or creatures, and feel entitled to point such readings out to others as a kind of miracle. Look, there's a face. There is no such thing as a perfect translation. But even in the awkward passage between one language and another, valuable goods are not only transferred, but transformed and refashioned as invention. Most of the familiar English forms, though described as traditional, the sonnet, the sestina, the heroic couplet, the villanelle, and now the pantoum, the gathalof, the modern haiku, are imperfect imports, generating centuries or at least decades of work in their new home. For a language as isolated as Hungarian, as you well know, it was and continues to be vital to translate foreign literatures. I have friends in Malaysia who are putting extraordinary energy into commissioning translations of world classics into Malay. Hungary is certainly not a parish bordering on silence. Malaysia, say my Malaysian friends, is in danger of cultural isolation. There are very few of us in the world translating from Hungarian into English at a reasonably high literary level, maybe 8 or 9 in prose, maybe 5 or 6 in poetry, and most of us are getting older. When I started translating from Hungarian, I did so out of a sense of gratitude. I was so thankful for what 1984 had given me that I gave up my visual work as an artist and have been translating constantly ever since. Some 30 novels and hundreds of poems later, I'm still doing so. What is it I'm grateful for? I no longer know. There, it was the opening up of my own imagined memory, the sense of another reality as embodied in voices, houses, streets, smells, the feel of history, and the sensation of presence, all aspects of the primal reality I mentioned earlier. I'm sure this is still true. It is just no longer as fresh. And after 1989, I don't even know for certain what it means to be Hungarian. I know what it is to be a translator, though, and I know what it is to be a poet. The original definition I gave of the transformation scene was that it was something performed in public of a possibly bawdy, burlesque, or cross-gender nature. So my last transformation, which I'm coming to now, is a set of perceptions in the form of jokes. You don't have to laugh. Or if not quite jokes, as reflections that strike me as comic or absurd, not so much cross-gender as cross-genre. They question the voice of the original, the voice of the translation, and most clearly the voice of the translator, who in this case happens to be a poet. So transformation scene 7, following the example of Roland Barthes and his Death of the Author, it's called The Death of the Translator. 1. The translator meets himself emerging from his lover's bedroom. So much for fidelity, he thinks. Rambo, you know, Rambo's very je en autre, which is a complete disorientation of all the senses. Je en autre, says the translator. Try next door. The translator was looking down his own throat. Come out, wherever you are. The translator's wardrobe was full of other people's shirts. At least they fitted him. The translator stood in front of the window pretending to be transparent. But if everything is potentially everything else, complained the translator, what am I doing here? The translator wanders to Babel and books himself into a cupboard. Two languages on the same floor of Babel. I was here first. I'm not talking to you. Keep the music down. You call that music? But the gardens of Babel, who talks about them? Who planted them? Who tended them? Cried the translator in his cups, slurring his words. The blind translator had developed his sense of smell to an exquisite pitch. He could read books the way a dog reads lampposts. The blind translator felt his way through the book, knocking whole sentences over. He'd have to build it all again by touch. A poet and a translator walk into a bar. Give me a beer, says the poet. I suppose you'd better give him a beer, says the translator. The translator was admiring his dead poets. Not that I'm alive myself, he remarked, but at least I keep moving. Several lungs, several breaths, several sets of teeth, several lips. We are several, says the translator. We are several, echoes the poet. The translator was tracking the bear, but kept wondering why the bear was wearing his shoes. Bears are thieves, he muttered. Two translators meet each other, examine their teeth. Whose teeth are those? They ask. They lined up the translators and shot them. Which one was the poet? Asked the soldier. Fourth one along. Maybe fifth. Not that it matters. The translator lay dead, but they buried someone else. Then they brought in someone else. Do you know legion, the idea of legion in the Bible? Legion, the devil is legion. So the last one. We are legion, says the devil. We are the foreign legion, answers a translator. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, George, for this splendid inaugural lecture, which in fact was an essay. Shall we read it in print? Did you plan to publish it somewhere? But yeah, in Transformation 6, you said our chief interest in you is as a translator and not as a bet. At this point, I'm afraid I have to contradict. You are elected to be a member of Seichin Academy as a poet and not as a translator. No translator can be a member, unfortunately. So you are a member as a poet. And well, from the very start, we've always had someone from Britain as an honorary member. Hotard Gözü, France, and Ted Hughes. And after, they unfortunately passed away. But now you are here as a full member. So the death of the translator, use this bathroom term, might be the birth of an author here at Seichin Academy. És akkor ez az a pillanat, amikor átadom a, nem teszem vissza, hanem a nehéz nevelni az oklevelet, amely tehát teljes jog.